Hey, what is up, fam? It's Dr. Dale, and thanks for joining me. I'm excited to dive into chapter three of my book, Diverse Medicine, Building a Stronger and Healthier Nation. So, you know, if you missed the first two, I did chapter one, I did chapter two already. This is the third chapter. Go back, you can check them out. It's on the podcast and Spotify, Google, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Also on our website, blackmenandwhitecoats.org. So check it out there. And, you know, I asked in the first two episodes, I'm going to ask again, if you haven't got a book, copy of my book, please do grab a copy of this book. I've published 12 books. I've written more, but I've published 12 books. And I honestly do believe that this book might be perhaps the most impactful as it pertains to gathering everything that I've learned over the years of doing work in this space and putting it together in a way that it's going to help people understand the issue of the lack of diversity in medicine, but it's also going to help people understand things we can do about it, why it's happening, the implications, but really, what should we be doing about it, right? So I think this book could be definitely a game changer. So please do grab a copy so you can just learn the information, or if you already know the information, or if you just want to support me, grab a copy just to support me. I truly would appreciate that. And if you enjoyed the book, please do leave a review. Again, you can grab a copy on Amazon.com. All right, so we're going to dive into chapter three of the book today. And if you've got your copy, go ahead and open up and we'll kind of scroll through the pages together. But really, we're just going to kind of go through and summarize it. So chapter three is a huge chapter. You know, I alluded to it at the end of chapter two, but I'm going to just dive into it now. So it's the benefits of a more diverse workforce. The benefits of a more diverse workforce. You know, a lot of times people might just think, oh, we're trying to hit quotas with diversity just to say we have it. And, you know, it's for this reason, for that reason. And sometimes people neglect to stop and take a minute to think about, okay, what are the actual benefits of having a more diverse medical workforce? Not even medical, really, almost any field. Diversity tends to bring benefits. So we're going to dive into some of the benefits, specifically as it pertains to medicine. And so, you know, I start the chapter off really just talking about lack of diversity in the field of medicine. I cover two groups. According to the AAMC report in 2023, just 5.7% of United States, of physicians in the United States, self-identified as black, and 6.9% as Hispanic. So only 5.7 self-identified as black and 6.9% as Hispanic, nowhere close to our national percentages in the population. And that's just, you know, thinking about, that's nowhere close to our national representation in the population, but that's not even taken into consideration the disparities on top of that, right? So you say, oh, 5.7% of physicians are black. You know, there's what, between 13 and 15% of people in the United States that are black, right? So we're already down significantly from that 13 to 15%, seeing that only 5.7% of us are black. However, in addition, you should be considering the disparities on top of that, right? What do I mean by that? Actually, got this from William McDade in our documentary, Black Men and White Coats. Dr. William McDade points this out. He's saying, you know what, let's say even if we did get to a place where 15% of our physician workforce was black, that still might not be enough. It may or it may not be, we don't know. But the point he was making is that might not be enough, because even still there are healthcare disparities on top of that we need to be considering. So we might need even more just to make up, to catch up to the disparities on top of that. And I thought that was a really insightful statement that he made. So that's huge. So we're already starting off in a very bad place in terms of the lack of diversity, right? And then in the book here, kind of the big thing that I want to kind of start with for this particular chapter is the thing that's going to get people's attention, money. Money talks. You start talking about, okay, what are the benefits? People want to know money, 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 money. If I can show you how to change your bottom line, right, you're going to pay more attention to what it is that I'm saying, right? So I start off this section, it's called Economic Impact of Diversity in Healthcare. I started off with a quote by unknown. I don't know who said it. You might. I don't know who said it, but I couldn't find it. It says, money doesn't discriminate, neither should we. Money doesn't discriminate, neither should we. And that's a really just straightforward, point blank, open your eyes type of thing, right? So if we're going to talk about how do we move things forward, hey, money's not going to discriminate. Let's go to the money and see what can happen there. And, you know, the book's not about money, so I didn't go into too much detail, but I did hit on a couple key things, right? So something that we've been talking about for as long as I can remember, considering anything about politics, is that the healthcare expenditure is 18% of the United States GDP, gross domestic products. 18%. 18%. You translate that into dollars, it comes out to be about $4 trillion. And in the book I write, to put this number in perspective, spending $1 million daily will take you almost 10,959 years to spend that $4 trillion. That's a lot of money. So we're spending tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons, and tons of money on healthcare in the United States of America. So, you know, what are some ways we can cut that down? That's constantly every 4 years, presidential elections, really every 2 years, right? For all, whatever elections pop up, people start talking about what can we do about healthcare expenditure, cut it down, right? Here's one thought. How about we work on making the workforce more diverse? So in 2017, the National Bureau of Economic Research, they conducted this study, right? They did an extensive study, and what they found ultimately was that diversity reduces costs. And at the end of the day, it said a more diverse workforce could potentially lead to a 20% reduction in healthcare costs. A more diverse workforce could potentially lead to a 20% reduction in healthcare costs. Think about that. I just said that 18% of the GDP is spent on healthcare, $4 trillion, right? Take that and say, okay, what happens if we reduce that by 20%? That's a significant amount of money. That's a significant amount of money, right? If you're able to reduce $4 trillion by 20%, that's some real cost savings there, right? Across the country that could then go into other things. You know, that's huge. All right, and then the other thing to think about when we talk about economic benefits, something that I don't think we consider enough is the idea of innovation. Diversity, and I'll hit on this a little bit later, but diversity brings innovation with it, right? When you have different mindsets, different ideas, innovation comes with that. Just because you have different perspectives and you can say, well, you know what? I've seen a problem like that before, or I haven't seen that problem, but here's what I can think of that might work based on my past experiences. It's people's past experiences to bring innovation to the table. So diversity brings innovation. When you have that, that's new ideas, new solutions, abilities to reduce costs. All sorts of those new ideas can bring down the cost of healthcare expenditure. That's huge. It's a really huge thing. I think a lot of times we just kind of talk over this and we glaze over it like it's not a big deal, but that's a big deal when you can have people coming in with new ideas. And I say this as an idea guy. So anybody who knows me, who's followed anything I've done for the past, whatever, 15 years, you know that Dr. Dale's an idea guy. Dr. Dale's always got ideas, right? Dr. Dale's made movies, he's made companies, he's made series, he writes books, you know. Dr. Dale's always got ideas, right? As an idea guy, I can tell you the power of an idea should not be underestimated. The power of an idea should not be underestimated. It can be a complete game changer. My life's changed multiple times because of what one idea can do, right? That's huge. Another study. So a study conducted by the University of Michigan in 2003, the university established a diversity council intending to promote diversity in healthcare. As a result of these efforts, the hospital achieved a remarkable 15% reduction in nursing turnover. That resulted for them in approximately $1 million in annual savings. So University of Michigan, they created a diversity council with the idea of promoting diversity in healthcare, right? Simple. As a result of that, they reduced nursing turnover, and that saved them $1 million a year. And honestly, I'm surprised that it was just $1 million. I would have thought it would have been significantly more than that. I wonder what would happen if they redid that study today, because that's just nursing. You're not even talking about what happens with physicians. I've heard estimates that in academic medical centers, the cost savings from one physician, like stopping the turnover, could be $250,000 to $500,000 just for one physician, because you have to bring in a new physician. You got to spend the money on recruiting. You got to spend the money on training them, getting them up to speed. And then you have to consider the money lost from that one physician that left and the time it's going to take for your new physician to ramp up, to build up your practice, to get plugged in and to, you know, just to get going at a steady state, right? It's a lot of money. All right, so the next section in this chapter is racial concordance and trust. Excuse me. Racial concordance and trust. So I'm just going to read this paragraph to you because I think it was so great. And I'll tell you the background. I was flying to, I had a speaking engagement somewhere. I don't remember. I believe, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the midst. Anyway, I had a speaking engagement. So I was flying on the plane and, you know, you're on the plane and you're trying to find something to watch. And I pull up this movie called Devotion, right? And it turned out to be a really good movie. I'd never even heard about it until I was on that plane. But it's called Devotion. Really, really good movie. And let me actually read. Let me grab my glasses. 1 second. I'm going to read to you just what I wrote in this paragraph because it's worth it. I just really like this. So, all right. Recently, I watched the movie Devotion starring Jonathan Majors. In the film, Majors portrays the black naval aviator, Jesse Brown, who battles racial discrimination while striving to become the best pilot he can be. In a poignant scene, Majors' character confides in his wingman, Hudner, played by actor Glenn Powell. He confesses his insecurities about learning to fly a new plane and being afraid to land it. Hunter then advises him to trust the white landing safety officer. When I say white, you know, the individual is Caucasian white. So Hunter then advises him to trust the white landing safety officer, they call him the LSO, who uses bright flags to guide pilots to safe landing. In response, Major's character answers, "Hard to believe that the LSO won't crash my black," and it says the A word, ASSS. "Hard to believe that the LSO won't crash my black bleep on purpose." Hearing those words, I immediately appreciated how that sentiment reflects a disturbing reality many underrepresented minorities face when seeking health care. So now we're talking about racial concordance and trust. Racial concordance and trust, right? So it's this general idea that for many underrepresented minorities, you come in, you walk in, you see a doctor that doesn't look like you. Sometimes you're thinking, can I trust them? You know, I've had multiple times in the hospital where patients will confide in me that they think you're being used as guinea pigs, right? Not once, right? This is something that happens, right? They'll be like, oh, you're using me as guinea pigs, right? And they feel as though the doctors come in to take care of them, don't really care about them, just trying stuff to see what's going to work, right? Which is not the case, you know, by and large. That is not the case, right? But that's what a lot of these individuals feel like. You know, in the book, I write about one particular case with Mr. Guy's name's not really Mr. Johnson, but I just called him Mr. Johnson in the book. Recent encounter, and again, these aren't infrequent happenings, right? I would imagine you could ask most URM physicians, they could tell you similar stories. But recent encounter, and you know, the guy just would not adhere to the medical recommendations in the hospital. He just wouldn't do stuff. Didn't want to get the procedures. Didn't want any of that stuff. And it's because, again, he thought that his physicians, in particular, he was concerned about Caucasian white physicians, were using him as guinea pigs, and he just didn't want to do anything. He was a black man. Didn't want to do any of the stuff that they were asking him to do. So, you know, I had to go there, I had to just kind of get real with him and just talk to him, kind of a heart-to-heart situation, like, hey, I get it. What you're saying, I understand what you're saying, right? I do this type of work. I do this diversity stuff. I pay attention to these things. I understand what you're trying to say. However, that's not the case here, right? That's not the case. All these doctors, they have your best interests at heart. I know these doctors, et cetera. At the very least, I'm here for you, even though that's not even it, right? We're all here for you, right? I personally know these doctors. They're looking out for your best interest, right? And I know me. I'm here for your best interest. We're going to tell you what we would do for ourselves, what we would want for our family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, after some time, you know, it broke through to him, and he decided to undergo the procedures and all those things that we were recommending, much to his benefit, I believe. However, I believe what happened was it took him seeing another black man for things to click and for him to actually trust what was going on, because he was not having it. He was not having it, right? So, I mean, this patient, you could have had a million docs come in here and talk to him. I'm not sure he would have had it. A million doctors who didn't look like him, I'm not sure that he would have done anything. But then I come in there, I take the time, I break it down to him. He sees the similarities between himself and me. Boom, he's with it, right? And that's not an infrequent thing. That happens. That happens. All right, let me kind of fast forward here. So one of the biggest studies, you know, came out 2018. It was a big deal when it came out about racial concordance. And when I say racial concordance, essentially what I'm referring to is the patient and the doctor being of the same race, right? The patient and the doctor being of the same race. Like, is there benefit in that? So a study came out 2018, and essentially what it showed was, it looked at black men patients, and essentially showed that when a black male patient had a black physician, male or female, when a black male patient had a black physician, they were more likely to adhere to the doctor's recommendations, similar to what I just demonstrated with Mr. Johnson in the book, right? They'd be more likely to listen to their recommendations about flu shots, cholesterol checks, you know, A1C, all that type of stuff, if their physician was also black. So there was positive racial concordance there, meaning that because they were black, the patients were more likely to listen, and ultimately we believe that will be better for their health care if you're willing to listen to their physicians. So that stuff matters. I want to take a moment. I'm always careful to be clear on this. Just because I'm a black doctor, that does not mean I can do a better job taking care of black patients. I know some doctors who I would say are way more intelligent than I am, right? I think I'm a pretty good doctor. But I know some doctors who I'll say are even way more intelligent than I am. And, you know, they might be able to take care of some patients better than I can, right? The idea of race isn't because I'm black and better than you. It's a thing of trust, right? Patients might be more likely to trust you. And one of my great friends and mentors, John Boaz, in our Black Man White Coast documentary also, he makes his points, you know, very astute point that at the end of the day, it's kind of what the patient thinks is kind of what matters, right? That's kind of what matters when you're taking care of somebody. If they feel as though they can't trust you, then that's what matters. If they feel as though they can trust you, then that's what matters, you know? So that's what it's about. It's about, does the patient trust you? That's one part of it. And then some of these studies have shown that the physician, when you see a patient that looks like you, you might be able to relate to them more, or be more sympathetic or empathetic towards them. So be willing to spend that extra 5 minutes with them, right? So whether intentionally or not intentionally, it's just whenever you see something, it might click in you, like, you know, subconsciously that, hey, this guy's kind of like me, this gal's kind of like me. You might be willing to spend more time with that individual. And in doing so, you're able to provide us a different level of care just because you might have spent an extra 2 minutes, you might have picked up on that bit of information in the H&P that actually really, really matters, right? All right. So access to care, when you're talking about, you know, increasing diversity in healthcare, access to care is always one of the huge ones. In general, people who are from a certain area are probably more likely to want to practice in that area. So if you grew up in, an underserved urban environment, you're probably more likely to want to go back there and to help the individuals from there. You know, in the book, I use my wife as an example of somebody who's just always wanted to work in the underserved. So my wife, Janae, and I, we started dating in college when we were freshmen in college, like, you know, a month after school started. We started dating over 20 years ago. And she wanted to be a vet at first, but I think I successfully convinced her to choose the route of being a medical doctor. Vet just ended up not being what she wanted to do. She changed. She decided on her own, of course, but ultimately she decided to go pre-med. So she went pre-med, ended up deciding to go to a school called Meharry. Meharry's in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a historically Black college and university. And she's just always wanted to serve, you know, the less fortunate. That's just what she's always wanted to do. And I hate saying the less fortunate. Maybe say those with perhaps less resources. And she's wanted that since as far back as I can remember. Undergrad, Meharry, that was on her mind, right? Because Meharry is very, very big on being able to provide care for the underserved. And she goes through med school, through residency, and she takes a job. She's a primary care physician. She takes a job, and she intentionally goes to look out for these communities. So she's been working in an underserved community, you know, since she finished her training, and that's what she wanted to do. She's always wanted to go to that type of community. She always thought, these people need help. I want to be there. I want to be in this environment. That's what she does. Passing up opportunities for a whole lot more money, right? But she wants to serve these patients. And I'd be lying if I, in the past, I haven't, the money hasn't been something to me. I'm like, oh, you know, you can go make more money over here doing that. That's what she wants to do, so that's what she's gonna do, right? And I fully support that, and I'm happy that's what she wants to do. So just thinking about individuals go through med school, everybody's like, yeah, I wanna go work in an unserved community, I wanna take care of those with less resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But who actually goes back and does it? You know, who actually goes back and does it, right? That's what's important. When you start talking about getting more diversity in healthcare, you start to see opportunities to get more physicians in these underserved areas and be able to provide that access to care that otherwise many of these patients wouldn't have had. All right. Let's fast forward here in the book. So in the next section, I talk about increased cultural competency. Increased cultural competency. And here's a quote from Mae Jemison. The more we learn about other cultures, the more we realize how interconnected and interdependent we truly are. Mae Jemison. All right. We want to learn about other cultures because we are connected. We do depend on each other. And then ask a quiz question. So here's a multiple choice question. Which of the three scenarios would allow you to learn the most about a particular culture? Option A, reading a book about that culture. Option B, spending meaningful time with people from that culture. Or option C, living in that culture. Obviously the answer is option C, right? Option C. Now, a lot of what I'm talking about here in this section is really about medical education. Right, so how do you get the doctors to have increased cultural competency? How do you get the nurses? How do you get the physician assistants? How do you get the dietitians, the physical therapists, all these individuals working in healthcare? How do you get them to have increased cultural competency? Right, it's very difficult to actually take them and go throw them to live in an environment. You know, some people aren't going to be ready for that. So you can't just take anybody and just throw them anywhere. They're not going to be ready for that. Right, so it's difficult to make that happen. However, the next best thing is what I believe might be the next step to take is to put them in situations where they don't have to live there, but put them around other people that have come from such environments, right? So let them learn in a diverse learning environment. Let them learn in a diverse learning environment. In our documentary, again, Black Men in White Coats, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, who is the president of Morehouse School of Medicine, says something, again, very astute. She notes that there's some medical schools in this country that don't have a single black male in your class. Some medical schools in this country that don't have not even one black male in their class. So tell me, if you're sitting in a classroom in med school and things are coming up, how are you going to get a deeper perspective of what a black male might think on something, right? And that's not to say that one black male represents all black males or one white woman represents all white women or whatever. That's not what it says. But at the end of the day, if you have more diversity in your class, you can get more diverse perspectives, which ultimately, in turn, can lead to increased cultural competency for the educated, for those being educated in the class. That's important. That is very, very important, right? So when we talk about increasing diversity in the field of medicine, part of it, what we want to consider is increasing the cultural competency of the caregivers, so the practitioners. And the big way to do that is by making sure you have diversity in their training environments, diversity of patients, but also diversity of those who are being trained with them, your colleagues, your co-students. In the book, I talk about when I first got to college, right? So I got paired with a roommate, a gentleman by the name of Matt. He's a white gentleman from St. Charles, Missouri, and, you know, I'm a black guy from Galveston County, right? Down in southern Texas, League City, Galveston County, Texas. I get there, I'm like, man, this kid's completely different from me. Are we gonna click? What's it gonna be like? For the most part, I thought I can get along with anybody, though, it's the type of guy I am. But still, you know, you're thinking about it. Like, man, are we gonna click? Oh my goodness, Matt and I became such great friends. He's such a great guy. You know, I learned so much about his culture. His friends became my friends became his friends, right? I learned so much about, like, him. I believe he learned so much about me. Every morning, one of my favorite things about Matt, and I never forget it, right? And this song always makes me remember him, is his alarm would go off, and his alarm in the morning would be Bob Marley playing Is This Love? Is this love, is this love, is this love, is this love that I'm feeling? Right? I'm not a singer, okay? But every morning, that alarm would go off, and I would just love that. And I learned so much about him, so much about, like, where he's from, and it was thinking back to it, it's so rejuvenating to think, like, man, just being around him and hopefully him being around me, you get to learn so many perspectives and you get to approach the world, you know, differently. And ultimately your impact becomes bigger, greater, because you've grown from that. And that's important to have in the classroom, in the learning environment, that diversity. All right, so let's fast forward to, so contributions to research and innovation. I told you guys we get back to innovation. Innovation is huge. You talk about why do you need diversity? Innovation. It's so huge. Research and innovation. I talk about this movie, Something the Lord Made. It's one of my favorite movies. It's a movie. It's got Mos Def in it. And it's a movie essentially about this guy, Vivian Thomas, and Alfred Blalock. They're doctors at Vanderbilt. And essentially, I don't want to like go through the whole movie, but basically what happens is Vivian Thomas, he wants to go to med school. You know, things weren't the right circumstances for him to be able to make that. It was back in the day. There was a lot more racial tension, et cetera, et cetera. So Thomas starts working in the lab with Dr. Alfred Blalock, who was a very highly respected, surgeon. I believe he was a cardiothoracic surgeon. And he starts working with him, and you're working on Blue Baby Syndrome, right? Trying to fix things for Blue Baby Syndrome. You're working on a lot of dogs and doing research and things of that sort, right? And then what ends up happening is they figure it out. They figure out how this here's how you solve it. Here's how you do the surgery. Here's how you do swap the vessels, et cetera, to fix the blue baby syndrome, right? So these kids aren't hypoxic and have all these issues anymore. So a patient comes who actually needs the surgery. So all this time they've been working on it on dogs. But a patient comes, this patient actually needs the surgery. I believe they were dogs, but whatever, they're working on animals. A patient comes and actually needs the surgery, right? So you're finally like, okay, we can do it, right? We can do it. Only issue is when the patient, you know, goes for operation, you know, black folks, they weren't letting black folks in the operating room. They just weren't doing that. So Vivian Thomas, who had actually done all this stuff, and he wasn't a doctor, actually. So maybe I shouldn't say they weren't letting black folks. I'd have to double check that. He wasn't a doctor. So it might have dealt with the fact that he wasn't a doctor. Whatever it was, there were racial undertones throughout the whole film. You have to go watch it yourself. But that's not the point that I'm making anyways. So finally, they go to the operating room, and Thomas can't go in the operating room. And, you know, Blalock's trying to just get started. He just can't do it, right? Because it's the guy who figured this out with him is not there. Granted, you know, Thomas did a lot of the work to figure this out. He's not there. And then, you know, Blaylock is like, hey, call for Vivian Thomas. Tell him to come to the OR, you know, so we can do this. And people kind of like, huh? I can't do that. Like, we're not gonna do that, right? And Blaylock, he's left the OR. He's at the operator station. Like, call for Vivian Thomas. You know, like, we can't do that. He's not allowed in the operator room. So finally, Blaylock just grabs the phone and does it himself. And one of my favorite lines in the movie is, you know, he's on the phone, the loudspeaker intercom. He says, Vivian Thomas, Paige and Vivian Thomas, you're wanted in the OR right now. Come on the run, do you hear? This is Blaylock. I love that line. It's when I hear that line, it just shows me, like, man, it's almost like a love in there. Like a love. The love that, and people might think, oh, it's just work, it's just job. Nah, but it's connection. It's like, hey, I need you here. Like, you're my guy. I need you for us to do this together. That's how I know how to do this thing, with us together, right? So he calls for him. You know, and Thomas gets up, runs, and you can see, like, the joy in other people's out there, eyes for him. You know, he runs, gets to the OR, and he walks in the operating room. Everybody's looking at him all crazy, like, huh, what's he doing in here? He shouldn't be in here, right? It's one of those theater styles, so you have other doctors, and they're watching him perform the surgery. And Thomas walks in there, and he guides Blaylock through the whole thing, right? And then it's a successful surgery. That innovation, right? That's to say that people from all races are intelligent. You don't want to exclude people, because had you not had a Vivian Thomas there, that might not have got figured out. We might still have blue baby syndrome today, right? Kids might still be suffering from that. And there's a lot more than that. Obviously, that's just one example, but there's tons of examples like that. But that innovation is important. People from different backgrounds will bring different perspectives to solving problems. So important. The next section I talk about is changing the narrative, and I tell a story about my son, Jace. One day, it's a couple of years back, and we're sitting at the dinner table, and we're talking about something, and then Jay says, Daddy, I can't be president. Uh-huh. Like, what do you mean you can't be president? You're a smart kid, right? You're social, intelligent. Like, of course you can be president. Why can't you be president? He's like, because I'm black. So my son, who at the time, I don't know how old he was, that I write it in the book, he was probably like maybe 7 or something at the time, thought that he couldn't be doctor because he was black, right? And granted, Obama, he was alive during some of the Obama years, but he was too young, right? So he doesn't understand that. I thought I couldn't be president because he's black. So there was a narrative already painted in his head of what he could and could not be. As a 7-year-old, there was a narrative in his head. I don't know, he was 6, 7, or 8, whatever. It was one of those years. But there was a narrative in his head of what he could become and what he couldn't become, just based on what he sees in society. So part of the reason I'm so passionate about getting diversity in healthcare, particularly among physicians, is because physicians are highly respected individuals in society. If I walk outside, people who know I'm a doctor, there's a different level of respect than if I just walk outside compared to people who don't know I'm a doctor. Physicians are highly respected in society. So when you start seeing more physicians from diverse backgrounds, I believe it gives the next generation of kids the belief that they can do things that otherwise they might not believe they can do. I see it all the time. We have our Black Men and White Coast Youth Summits across the entire country. So we're traveling across the country, hosting these youth summits for thousands of kids, you know, across the country. And we see them, some of them go from, like, I didn't know I could do this, right? You're planting the seed in your head, letting them, like, hey, yeah, you can do this. So it's changing the narrative for them. And not just for them, but it's also changing the narrative for individuals who see us, to see us. Hey, you know what? This guy, Dr. Such and Such, you know, he's a phenomenal doctor, right? And he's African-American or Hispanic or whatever, right? Native American, like, that subconsciously, that adds another little, you know, something, chip, right, to that stack in somebody's mind of, hey, those people from that background, they're smart. And it's adding subconsciously. And, you know, with time, eventually, these narratives start to change and shift, right? These narratives do start to change and shift. That's huge. And to bring it home, you know, the last thing I talk about is this idea of increased life expectancy. Huge article came out. And what the article showed, I'm just going to read you a highlight section from my book. It says, the results of the study are truly astounding. The investigators found that as the percentage of black primary care doctors increased within a community, the life expectancy of its residents also significantly rose. Let me read that again. I apologize. I'm not wearing my glasses, so I've got to squint. So the results of the study are truly astounding. The investigators found that as the percentage of black primary care doctors increased within a community, the life expectancy of its residents also increased. That's huge. It's not saying that the life expectancy of the black residents also increased. The life expectancy of all the residents in general increased. So just by having more black doctors in the community, the life expectancy of everybody increase. These benefits are real. Why does that happen? I don't know, right? But these benefits, you're seeing them, they're being studied. They're real things, right? So diversity does matter. There's so many benefits. And, you know, I apologize. This section's gone on longer than I expected it to. But, and I didn't even hit on all the benefits. There's so many more. There's just a few of the benefits that are diving into. But it's such a huge thing to get diversity in healthcare. And obviously, you can tell I'm passionate about it. I talk fast when I get passionate. I'm talking fast right now because I believe in this concept of diversity helping to make things better, right? So that was the benefits of diversity. Next chapter is going to be racism in medicine. Racism in medicine. That's a huge chapter, guys. You don't want to miss that one. That's going to be a huge chapter. And the general idea, really, okay, you don't want to miss it, but if you haven't bought the book, please go buy the book and read the chapter, right? Read the chapter. If you have the book, definitely read the chapter before you watch the video. That way you have a background and we'll talk through it on here. But it's huge, right? And I'm going to actually explain how systemic racism comes about in that chapter, which I think is something that we don't talk about enough. And I'm not sure I've really heard anybody describe it the way I have, even though it's so simple. But we'll talk about that next. So thanks for going through chapter 3 with me. If you don't have a copy, please grab a copy. Diverse Medicine, Building a Stronger and Healthier Nation. Grab your copy on Amazon. And if you like it, please do leave a review. Thank you guys so much. I'm excited to dive into the next chapter with you.